Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies Game Night, Annihilation, and Every Day. And I'm also going to be talking about some recent films, The Campus and The Ritual. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring Lady and the Tramp. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The piece of news I'm going to hit on quickly, because we have another sexual misconduct story, and it came out that Brendan Fraser said that he had some sexual misconduct happen to him. And the reason this made news is because he's a guy, and most people think, oh, sexual misconduct, that all happens to women, and it does to a greater degree by about twice as much. I saw a number that says about 80% of women say that they've faced it, but like 40-some percent of men have faced it in some way, shape, or form. And this dovetails along with the accusations that Terry Crews had about an agent who groped him at a party. And of course, Terry Crews is a big, strapping, huge, massive guy. I wouldn't want to cross the guy's path. I mean, he sounds like he's a teddy bear, but he's imposing. So it doesn't just happen to people who would be otherwise perceived as weak or vulnerable. I mean, Brendan Fraser's a big dude, and he was well known in the industry. And the incident allegedly happened in 2005, and it involved him and Philip Burke, who was a former president of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which, of course, is the organization that runs the Golden Globes. And look, I mean, I don't doubt that this kind of stuff happens, although when you read the story, it's they have conflicting accounts. You know, Burke says he maybe made a little pass on him in jest, and then Brendan Fraser's like, no, my recollection is this. And when you read the account, you're kind of thinking, well, the guy has to be really short. It almost doesn't. At some point, you have to sit there and wonder how this, you know, it's kind of hard to wrap my brain about how this happened if Brendan Fraser couldn't just walk away, even take a step back kind of thing, or forward. But originally I was like kind of rolling my eyes at this, mainly because not that I don't believe that it happened, because I absolutely believe it happened, but that he talked about going into depression and was kind of becoming reclusive, and people are saying, oh, well, what happened to Brendan Fraser? Brendan Fraser's still around, man. Brendan Fraser really hasn't had a dip in his movies. Oh, yeah, he's not getting The Mummy, because he hasn't held up the way Tom Cruise has. I mean, Tom Cruise isn't even doing great with The Mummy. So when they remade that, I mean, yeah, he did The Mummy franchise from, what, 1999 to 2008? And now they've got Tom Cruise doing it, and that barely made it off the ground. Brendan Fraser used to have a really, you know, not just promising blockbuster career, but he did, like, art picks like Gods and Monsters and The Quiet American. But, I mean, doing movies like Extraordinary Measures and Furry Vengeance, that kind of soured his career, and he's no longer the young, he's not aging as well as some actors do. I mean, that's just a fact, and he's sort of, there's a level of cheesiness to him that doesn't work when you've got somebody in their 40s doing a movie versus somebody in their 20s doing a movie. But when I actually went to the original source, it comes from a GQ article, and I'm kind of like, well, I don't necessarily blame Fraser, because it sounds like he was just swerved into this conversation with GQ, and then GQ published it in their piece, and then everybody picked up this one little piece. He's going on talking about his kids and his horses and his everything else, and this is what everybody is focusing on. So Brendan Fraser's never left. He's been around. He's been steadily working this whole time, and we wasn't invited to the Golden Globes as often because he was doing movies like Furry Vengeance. Next piece of news, just real quick, and I'll talk about a little bit more in the box office segment, just a little bit about Black Panther's box office. It was incredible, and I'm not surprised that it did very well. But I think that I'm surprised, and I think everybody else is surprised, it did as well as it did. Nobody was predicting this much. I heard predictions, I think the highest prediction I heard going into the weekend was $180 million, and it smashed that. And that's fantastic. I think that the stars really aligned for this one. Marvel series. You had the formula, but it was something different. It kind of goes into a James Bond type of movie rather than your typical Marvel movie. Helped being Black History Month and having Ryan Coogler as the director and almost all black cast and production heads also in the film. The production heads, a lot of them were people of color. And then the social movement kind of comes as a 1-2 punch from Wonder Woman last year, which was a socially relevant film, but also a very good movie. But the biggest struggle is going to be when they do Black Panther 2. Can they replicate this amount of success? This is what happened with the Avengers. When the Avengers came out, it did so well that there was no way the second one was going to live up to it. Let's see if they can do that. And then you're starting to see them compare box office numbers. Like I've heard somebody report that it beat Avengers Age of Ultron's 4-day. Well, of course it beat that. Why? Because the Monday was a regular work and school day. So you can't really compare that fourth day because Black Panther had the advantage of coming out on President's Day. And a lot of schools will actually work sometimes, some schools will take that Friday off and, you know, it balances it out. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is The Incredibles 2, which opens on June 15th.
Superheroes are illegal.
We want to fight bad guys.
I am a bad guy.
It defines who I am.
We're not saying you have... What?
Someone on TV said it.
I was approached by this tycoon. Wants to talk about hero stuff.
Help me bring supers back into the sunlight. We need Elastigirl.
Bye, sweetie.
I'll watch the kids, no problem.
I couldn't have done this if you hadn't taken over so well.
I've got to succeed so she can succeed.
What's funny about this is you get sort of a hodgepodge of stuff from the story. You don't get a real sense of the full story. I mean, obviously the setup is Mr. Incredible is taking care of the kids and Elastigirl is off basically being the superhero. And I actually have a connection to that because when my wife and I had kids, she actually had the better paying job. So she's the one who kept it, and I stayed home with the kids, which allowed me to, at home, develop a business of doing movie reviews and radio as I raised the kids. So I know what it's like seeing your wife go off to work and you stay at home with the kids. So, this shouldn't be that odd of a story premise now, but it is. I mean, it's a Mr. Mom kind of thing. But, I mean, Mr. Mom was 30-some years ago. This should not be that odd for people to wrap their brain around. So I'm curious as to what the actual story is, but I have faith. I mean, this looks like it looks authentically like it's going to be a great sequel. And I love The Incredibles. It's one of my favorite Pixar movies. Looking forward to that. The next one I want to hit is I don't cover TV all that much. And this really isn't TV as much as internet. But I had to find, I saw this trailer this week and I said, I got to talk about this. And that's Cobra Kai, which comes sometime in 2018 to YouTube Red.
Fighting positions. Fire!
I just don't know why you'd ever want to bring back Cobra Kai.
You're not trained to be merciful here. Mercy is for the weak.
You may know the moves, but none of that matters unless you have balance.
Are you ready to learn the way of the fist?
Yes, Sensei!
Johnny. You and I, we aren't done.
This is, of course, the follow-up to the Karate Kid saga, and it's about Ralph Macchio and Billy Zabka reprising their roles, and they work to build a new dojo together, and it's going to be a series. And, I think probably the premise is a greater premise than it's going to necessarily be. It may not be that great. YouTube Red's done some interesting stuff. But I don't know how sustainable this is. Once you get the Karate Kid and Johnny from Cobra Kai together on the mat again, it's what you follow that up with. But still, it's, you know, a child of the 80s. I was, you know, I grew up with the Karate Kid. I was a teenager when that came out. So yeah, I thought this is going to be probably at least pretty fun. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Game Night and Every Day. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews, and let's kick things off with Game Night. Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams star as a married couple whose murder mystery kidnapping game turns out to be all too real.
Tonight, we're taking Game Night up a notch.
Oh, boy. Mm.
Someone in this room is going to be taken, and it's going to be up to you to find them.
It's a murder mystery party.
Whoever finds the victim wins the grand prize.
Wait a sec. You can't just come in here and break the door.
That's so real.
First one that follows us gets shot.
Okay, roger that. You drive safe.
It's not a joke. You people are in real danger.
Is this gun real?
Oh no, Andy.
This premise could be a comedy or a drama or a thriller. I mean, it could go either way. Now, it's obviously a comedy. It's got Jason Bateman in it, and he's done drama before, and I think he's a great dramatic actor. But he's best known for comedy and sort of that sardonic, sarcastic, suburbanite, possibly jerk dad. He works in that role. And Rachel McAdams is actually given a chance to do something a little different than what she's normally. Normally, she's like just a love interest, which is sad because she's a good actor. I mean, she's done some great stuff like The Family Stone. And I think one of the things that's always kind of held her back a bit from a little more broad comedy and a little bit more broadcasting is she's so good looking. She is so beautiful that she's not relatable. And which is why she ends up in movies like The Notebook and The Time Traveler's Wife and About Time. And she's good in those roles, sure. But like, that's one of the reasons why I loved her in The Family Stone, because she's still gorgeous in sweatpants, but they're downplaying her as a just totally gorgeous woman because she's got talents. And she's sort of doing the Natalie Portman thing with Doctor Strange, where I feel like she's kind of slumming it for the Marvel movies, but I think it's great that she has a chance to do some comedy because she's good at comedy. And that way I don't have to just see clips of her in The Notebook all the time. But it's got a good cast because it's got them and it's got Lamar. I can't remember his last name, but he's from New Girl. He played Winston. And there's also some smaller parts that are kind of surprising cameos I wouldn't want to say because I don't want to spoil any surprises. But really, Jesse Plemons, he is the one who steals the show in this movie. He plays their creepy next door neighbor who's also a cop who never takes off his uniform. But he's done, you know, very dark stuff, like he did Black Mass, and he was in Breaking Bad as a really sociopathic character. He's fantastic in this movie as that creepy neighbor who you never want to do Game Night with, but he ultimately is a nice guy kind of thing. So he kind of steals the show. I give him credit because he steals the show. He has not as many scenes, but boy, every single scene he's in. Just watch a trailer with him. He's hilarious in the trailer, and it's not just the funniest scenes in the movie. So Game Night works because it manages to balance the thriller aspect with the comedy. One of the problems when you get to be a comedy where people are really in danger in that sort of thriller mentality is that when the people don't take it seriously or they almost play it up too much for laughs. It's written and directed by the guys, they wrote Horrible Bosses, so they got a little bit of history writing for Jason Bateman. And I think they retooled this script, so this isn't their original script. And they also did the Vacation remake, or reboot, from a couple years ago. Now, the Vacation reboot, they played the humor too heavy. They couldn't let the joke land. They put it there, they pointed out the joke, and then they hit the joke a couple times with the hammer. They overdid it with Vacation. I think they may have learned their lesson a bit with this movie in the sense that they let the humor play out for itself, and in that sense, it actually works, and it becomes quite entertaining. And at times, it's not perfect. It's not perfect. It's not as, I don't think it's as consistently funny as like Horrible Bosses was. And probably the funniest parts are where it swerves out of the story, because it has that story of, you know, the brother getting kidnapped and them trying to go find him and being sent on this wild goose chase. But at a certain point, the movie diverts into these little pockets of bits and jokes and gags that they sometimes take a couple minutes to play out. And those are actually sometimes funnier than the actual story itself. And it's a little bit awkward kind of moving into this 5-minute bit or longer, that where you really are like, well, this is irrelevant to the rest of the story. but it makes the movie funny, and the movie does kind of move to the speed it's supposed to. So ultimately, it does work. It has quite a few laughs. I found it a nice diversion. It's not perfect. I liked Horrible Bosses better, but still, I'm gonna have to say that Game Night kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next movie, which is Every Day. A high school girl falls in love with a spirit that wakes up in a different body every day.
I am someone who wakes up in a different body every day. Always someone my age. I'm never too far from the last, never the same person twice. And I have absolutely no control over any of it. The day that Amy shadowed you at school, I was Amy. And the day that you went to the beach with Justin, I was Justin.
It's not possible.
It is.
Why are you doing this?
The day we met, I felt something I've never felt before. And I don't want to let that go.
This is based on a best-selling book. And I have to ask, what is it about... I know what it is. I know the answer, but I'm rhetorically saying, what is it about these romances where you have this humdrum, average, normal, everyday, nothing special about her whatsoever, teenage girl who falls in love with some eternal spirit or magical entity or something like that? It's done because it's fodder for average, humdrum, everyday teenage girls to read and be like, I'm special because I would be the one that would attract the 100-year-old vampire, or I'd be the one who would attract this spirit that moves from body to body every day. It just seems such a big pill to swallow at this point, and at times it seems to be such an excuse to get to the romance. I've not seen this because it wasn't screened, so I'm going by the trailer. But the trailer looks corny as all get out. But like, that's what it is with Twilight, where it's there's nothing special about Bella. Bella is completely uninteresting and boring. Yet every single vampire, she is the focus of the world. And that plays into the emotional sensitivity of teenage girls. For the Twi moms, it plays into the latent memories of this, of not feeling special. You know, movies, like same thing with 50 Shades of Grey, which is essentially fan fiction for Twilight with the names changed. Or what was that movie, The Space Between Us, about the kid from Mars who then comes down and falls in love with this girl on Earth? I mean, he was from Mars, for crying out loud. It's always got to be that something so, I mean, it can't just be an average dude. They have to be super special. And that's kind of the irritation of these movies, where it's just like, it's then just throwaway love story for teenagers. And also I look at this and going, well, why doesn't he just give her a phone number, or she, it? It's, there's entities genderless because it moves from body to body. But why doesn't the entity just memorize her phone number, and then every time it wakes up, it's like, calls her, hey, here I am, come over to this place. Hey, here I am, I'm going to be here. Here I am, I'm going to be here. It sounds like the process for them to get together is going to end up being a lot harder than it should. So I don't know. I mean, these kind of movies, I know I'm not the target market, and I understand that there's a whole audience that loves these kind of things. It's just not for me. It wasn't screened, so it probably is terrible or only limited to that very, very limited market. But I'm going to have to say that Every Day gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Annihilation and The Campus. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. I want to talk about Annihilation. A woman joins a team that enters a mysterious atmospheric anomaly that threatens to take over our world.
It's something they termed the Shimmer. We've sent in drones and teams of people, but nothing comes back. The boundary's getting bigger, it's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside.
So do I.
Check this out.
It's like they're stuck in a continuous mutation.
Anything interesting in there?
No.
This is a movie that seems to be very similar, at least connective tissue-wise, with other films. One of them that it reminds me a lot of is Arrival. not the Arrival with Charlie Sheen back in the 90s, Arrival, the one with Amy Adams that came out a year and a half ago. It was directed by Denis Villeneuve, and it was nominated for an Oscar. Now, I've gone on the record to say I liked a lot of aspects of Arrival. I thought it wasn't as smart as people were giving it credit to, and I didn't think it was as great of a movie as everybody said it was. But it does remind me of that, where you take this woman's played by Natalie Portman in this one, but she's brought to this area where there's this possibly alien anomaly or alien contact, and she has to go investigate. And so it kind of has that same feel to it. It also has a little bit of a feel to, if I'm going to be talking about The Ritual a little bit later, there's some connective tissue there in terms of the setting and the feel of part of the movie, because part of the film is the setup of her getting to this anomaly. But when her and her team goes in, she's essentially kind of on this backpacking mission, militaristically, not on vacation, but a backpacking mission to try and get to the source of this. It's directed by Alex Garland, who is best known for directing and writing Ex Machina a couple years ago. But this is based on a book, so he's adapted it into a screenplay. And it's very heady science fiction. It's very high concept. It is not your typical bubblegum guy in an iron suit fighting crime. Or even like last week, Black Panther. Black Panther, as much as I loved Black Panther as a movie, I fully admit it's kind of a James Bond superhero kind of film. You can have warts all over this thing, and you slick it up with action and effects and some cool character moments, and you can ignore a lot because it's comic book, it's popcorn. This is a lot more risky of a science fiction piece because it is meant to be realistic. That's the way Arrival was. That's why I respected Arrival. Even if all of its intricacies and plot elements don't quite work, the devil is in the details, and the details are so easy to see in a movie like this that's meant to be very realistic. So I give a certain amount of forgiveness to this, because the film, it's her husband, played by Oscar Isaac, had gone on a military mission and then shows up a year later. He's lost his memory and stuff, and he starts to get sick, and she's then transported to this faraway place where they're going after this anomaly. And Jennifer Jason Leigh plays the leader of the mission, and she's like, well, we've sent in drones, we've sent in people, we've sent in animals, nothing returns. But there are some holes in this. Part of it that bothers me is when you have a high-concept sci-fi piece like this, as cool as it can be, and it has such neat special effects, and it has such out-of-the-box thinking, as neat as this movie is, it's so easy to see the holes in it. They don't know anything about what's beyond this wall of the anomaly, because everybody they sent in hasn't come back. And I'm like, well, did you try a stick? That's the first. So when I can like poke the holes through the setup, it's very hard for me to get into the movie. And I'm like, well, you just stick a camera in there on the end of a stick and then pull it out and look around. You go, oh, okay, we see what it is. Oh, it seems like time's distorted. Let's put a watch on the end of a stick. Stick it in there. Pull it out. Oh, it's consciousness is involved. Okay, let's put an animal in. But they don't just send it, put it on a leash and then pull it back out or put it in a cage. Why didn't they use canaries? Why didn't they use a dog on a leash? Why didn't they send in a team to just stand there for 5 minutes and then come back out? You should be able to have a certain amount of study on the outside looking in. And there, it seemed like they just went for broke. And they said, oh, we got to get to the source of this thing, and we're not going to test stuff. They had like 3 years to test this anomaly, and they don't. And that's where it breaks down for me, because I'm like, these are the dumbest smart people on the planet working on this problem. And then even when they get in there and weird things start to happen, and I'm not even going to go into it because it's kind of out there, even then they're not reacting the way normal people should or scientists should. And you know, they should be gathering information, but they're going all for broke. And there's no sense in exploring something if you can't get back to share your data. That's what science is. So there are some plot holes in this, and there are some setup issues that don't quite work for me. And then there are moments where in this team that goes in, they do some really stupid things, and the character moments do really break down. And I think he's trying to show them break down, kind of, they're all going kind of mental to a degree, But he doesn't show that very well, and it kind of just, it gets really stupid somewhere in the middle. And then it picks up. I mean, it does redeem itself a bit near the end. It's a little predictable, but overall, I mean, it's a neat movie. It's different than anything else you're going to see right now in the theaters. And for that reason, it's worth checking out. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is The Campus. After her father's death, a woman returns to his place of business only to become the target of a demon that he had made a deal with years ago.
Welcome home, sis.
When I was a young man, I made a deal. I made a deal to sacrifice something that I never thought that I'd actually have.
What are you doing here? You know there's no money, right?
The human soul is comprised of 5 pieces. In order for the devil to take a soul, he needs all 5.
There's no way out.
This is a smaller movie, and it is currently available on demand on various outlets, Amazon, iTunes, in a couple weeks. And I like to cover smaller movies now and then because I think it's worth checking out the innovative stuff. And it turns out to me, I've always said this, that the real innovative stuff for horror is happening on the independent side and the on-demand side. The big budget horror movies like The Conjuring, those are fun, and I like those. But the real innovative stuff is happening below the surface. And it always has been. This kind of movie is like the kind of thing that like George Romero used to make. I mean, not talking Night of the Living Dead, everybody, that became a phenomenon. I'm talking about stuff like Season of the Witch or Martin. These little movies that you may have never seen in your regular theaters, that you only saw on video or late night television, that are very low budget. And you know, I mentioned warts on Annihilation. These movies have warts to them because, you know, they don't come with this $50 million budget and, you know, a shooting schedule of weeks with reshoots and that sort of thing. A lot of these things are shot like over the course of a week or so. So in The Campus, it's a relatively contained thriller, and it takes a little bit of time to get into it. It really has a little bit of a rumbly start. But once it gets going, it kind of breaks things down because this demon's haunting her. It's the devil, but I don't know if it's really the devil or if it's just sort of like in The Exorcist pretending to be the devil. It's sort of going after her with 5 pieces. And so essentially what you get is you get this 5-part movie where they break it down into different genres of horror. You had sort of like a home invasion type of attack. Then you have a body horror. Then you have a zombie version. You know, so the each one has its own, it's like its own little horror movie. It's like this anthology of 5 horror movies kind of telling the same story. And that's interesting. And it's innovative. Because it's on demand, it probably could have gone a little gorier earlier. I mean, it eventually gets gory, but I remember thinking about halfway through, I'm like, wow, they really could have gone like The Descent. If you ever saw the movie The Descent by Neil Marshall, they're just, I mean, just covered in blood in that movie. And they could have stepped that up earlier, but that could have been budgetary as well. Overall, it's an interesting little horror film that shows that you can still do some interesting stuff on a small budget. So I'm going to have to say The Campus kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Ritual, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Lady and the Tramp. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The Ritual, which actually debuted on Netflix the first week of February. I don't feel the need to necessarily get ahead of these movies because the ones on Netflix people can discover. It seems that when it comes to Netflix, and Amazon seems to be going this way, their big push and awareness of what shows up on the service seems to be angling more and more towards scripted television. They're talking about doing series. They want you to binge watch. So when they drop Stranger Things, or like recently they dropped Altered Carbon on Netflix or one of the Marvel series, or they're really promoting that Jack Ryan show for Amazon that doesn't even come out till August, they want people to binge watch it so they can get really high numbers. Sometimes these Netflix original movies, they drop them with a little bit of fanfare, but they expect people to find them, and they just tend to trend, and they think they have a longer lifespan because they don't need to watch everyone to watch it all at once. I mean, that works sometimes for stuff like Bright or even the Cloverfield Paradox, which got a huge push of like 5 million views that first week. But I think they also kind of just want them on there and just keep bringing in the viewers. So sometimes I'm going to hit these ones that are a little bit, a couple weeks old. And I'm going to do that with The Ritual. After their friend dies, a group of mates from England travel to a remote hiking trail in Sweden, only to find themselves being stalked by a mysterious creature in the woods.
You know, they have walking trails in England.
Look, we go southwest through here.
We cut the journey in half.
Or through the forest?
Yeah, why not?
Now, is it me, or is it really quiet in here?
We shouldn't be here.
Luke, you're getting soaked.
Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear anything. Come on.
There's a certain amount of connective tissue with this and Annihilation. And the reason I'm saying that is because you're talking about creatures in the woods, and it's shot the same way. Now, The Ritual goes far more horror than Annihilation, but even then, some of the creature elements are similar. It was just weird watching. I watched both of these movies on the same day, and I noticed a lot of connective tissue, completely unrelated to each other. But this seems to be an archetype we're starting to see show up, which is great because I love that over, found footage or that kind of garbage. It also does remind me a lot of The Descent because of some of the themes. In The Descent, this woman, she goes on a trip with her friends and they go spelunking. And she's doing it partly to get over the grief that comes from the death of her daughter, which happens at the beginning of that film. And of course, she ends up having to come through the other end quite literally in The Descent. And in this one, they're trying to get over the death of a friend of theirs who they normally do guys' weekends with or guys' trips with. And one of them feels somehow responsible for it. And so there's a lot of guilt. And at times, the guilt bleeds in with the monster, and it's sort of this dream logic imagery that permeates this film. And that makes it... It uses the dreams better than most dream sequences. Most dream sequences are garbage in movies. This one, it weaves it in there, and there's a reason for it. It does have that feel of these somewhat archetypal stories of cabin in the woods, hikers in the woods being attacked by creatures, crazy hillbillies, that sort of thing. But it takes place in Sweden. So it's nice to see a crazy hillbilly movie without crazy hillbillies in Appalachia. So... I did enjoy this one. It is one of those movies where the people kind of just get on each other's nerves so much. I wouldn't want to spend a week with these guys in the woods. I don't know why they do. But overall, I mean, it's a grisly at times, a scary movie that actually pays some things off. And as opposed to like that movie, It Comes at Night last year, which had a great setup, very similar setup in the woods. Something creepy's out there. There's something. But then that movie just had nothing. And this one has stuff, and it does have a payoff, and it does have a certain historic relevance to it as well. It's worth checking out. If you've got Netflix, watch it. It's a nice alternative in terms of horror movies, and it's not so grisly and dark that, it's not driving things into the ground, but it's also not just, bubblegum horror. It's not some... PG-13 nonsense horror that they're going to release to scare girls at slumber parties. So I'm going to have to say The Ritual kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Just a couple things about the box office. So just not to just continue with the point too much, but Black Panther, it was the fifth largest opening of a three-day weekend ever behind The Avengers, Star Wars The Force Awakens, Jurassic World, and I think The Last Jedi. I can't remember, but no one expected this. So it reminds me a lot of The Avengers. And when you look at it, it's basically Star Wars, The Avengers, and Jurassic Park are the ones that are dealing with this massive, massive audiences. And this weekend, it's going to win again. I mean, it's just the question of how much. I mean, going into the weekend, people... we're predicting $120 million for Black Panther. Going into last weekend, and this weekend. So, you know, God knows what's going to happen. I mean, it's probably going to suffer a certain drop, but I think it's going to be more along the lines of the dip that you saw for Jurassic World and the Avengers than you did for, like, The Last Jedi, which had a much bigger drop-off because that buildup of anticipation for the first movie is not nearly as strong as in the sequel. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This actually doesn't come out until next week, so we have a couple days until you can actually get your hands on a copy of this. But I figured I'd cover it because I got other stuff to cover next week, and that is Lady and the Tramp. This beloved Disney classic returns to Blu-ray, telling the story of a purebred dog who falls in love with a roguish stray.
It's for you, darling.
Happy is the heart that's feels pain.
Darkness drains you and light will come again.
Everybody, everybody wants to love. Everybody, everybody wants to be loved. Oh, oh, oh. Just let the love, love, love begin.
Open up your eyes to what a dog's life can really be.
One of the most brilliant things that Disney has done, and they did this starting, oh gosh, I remember them doing this on VHS. They would make a movie available on home video, and then they'd pull it off of the shelves, and then they'd put it back like 5 years later. And they've done that for decades. And that's served them very well, because with these classics like, you know, Lady and the Tramp or Cinderella or Snow White, you always have a new generation wanting to buy a copy, and they can release a new version and promote it. And, you know, if you want something that's out of print, that's sometimes a little harder to get. But you just have to wait around. I think the last time they brought out Lady and the Tramp was like 5 or 6 years ago. It was when the Blu-ray first came out. And it went out of print, and now they've got this out again. So if you haven't gotten Lady and the Tramp and you're a big fan, now's the time to buy Lady and the Tramp. And it gets... I mean, the movie itself, I mean, what else can you say about the movie that hasn't been said? I mean, the movie's, what, 60-some years old? It's a beautiful little sweet story. It's a love story. It has one of the best love story scenes. Has a weird moment where I never even noticed this when I saw it as a kid, and it wasn't later until I was watching it and actually heard a commentary on it. There's a scene where the dogs spend the night together, and they're trying to tiptoe around it in the movie, but they're really basically saying, what's going to happen to her reputation? Which is really cute. But this new Blu-ray, it pushes the fact that there are three ways to watch it. And those three ways are, of course, the original theatrical version and the sing-along version, which is new. And so that's like if you got kids and you want to sing the song. This doesn't have as memorable of songs. I mean, the Siamese cat songs, memorable. Yeah, the Italian restaurant scene where he sings, that's more notable for the spaghetti moment than it is for the music. This is not really one of the better remembered musicals, but you do have that. You do have the sing-along, and then you also have Inside Walt's story, meaning, which is the kind of thing they've been doing on these Blu-rays and DVDs for years. I mean, obviously, the people who worked on this movie are long gone. Walt Disney is long gone. So they have all this stuff in the archives at Disney where they pull out, where they've got recordings, and Walt would record his story meetings, and so you hear him and the animators talking, and then they cut that together. And so it does have some new special features, and mostly focusing on the dogs. It has stuff with Walt Disney and the dog characters, obviously, and you know, just more sort of archival stuff. You saw that with like the Bambi release and that sort of thing, where there's not a whole lot of brand new stuff that you can do for a movie that's this old. And it's had multiple DVD and Blu-ray releases. So the real selling point isn't necessarily special features, although it does give that digital download version that's much more accessible through Movies Anywhere. But overall, still Lady and the Tramp. If you don't have it, get it. It's worth checking out. Comes out next Tuesday. And it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other releases that are out this week include Daddy's Home 2, Mom and Dad, and The Star. And that's it. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Red Sparrow and Death Wish, and of course, my Oscar predictions. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.